The following is an excerpt from the Science Magazine podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Now, Science's Lauren Schenkman sitting in for David Graham with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news from our online daily news site, Science Now. Happy New Year, Lauren.
Happy New Year, Rob.
So you've given me a bit of a preview, and I understand this first story is about fighting global climate change by eating bugs. How exactly does that work?
Well, a lot of people choose to eat local food because they think they're reducing their carbon footprint because the food doesn't have to travel very far. And, you know, a lot of people are interested in finding ways to eat that's more environmentally friendly. Well, it turns out that the most environmentally friendly way to eat meat is actually to eat bugs. And there's some people who have actually put some hard numbers on this.
Is it something about the bugs themselves? I mean, they still have to consume.
It's actually, these researchers specifically looked at which greenhouse gases they gave off and how much and how that compared to cows and pigs. So they looked at 5 species of insects, including mealworms and house crickets, and measured the output of carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxide, which are 3 greenhouse gases. And it turns out that all 5 and 6 species, pound for pound, gave off much less greenhouse gases than cattle. And 4 out of the 5 bugs did better than pigs. So it turns out that if you really are environmentally conscious and want to eat in a way that's good for Mother Earth, you should go for mealworms because they churn out less than 1% as much greenhouse gas as cows. And house crickets pollute even less. So those are a good option too.
What accounts for the difference? Something about the bug's metabolism or what?
Well, yes, because cows spend a lot of energy keeping themselves warm, whereas bugs use more of their energy to plump up.
So the numbers are there in terms of at least the pound for pound comparison. What about the environmental impact of raising that many bugs compared to the environmental impact of raising the cows and pigs that we do today?
Well, that's a question that remains to be answered. You have to take into account everything that goes into raising a cow versus raising a grasshopper, especially in the amounts that grasshoppers would need to be raised in order to make a meal. So that's something that these researchers say they're going to look into.
Have you ever tried a cricket burger?
I can't say I have, but this researcher says that they have excellent structure and flavor and that mealworms are pretty good in a quiche.
Okay. Yuck. Well, thanks, Lauren. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, from crickets and mealworms, let's now turn to bumblebees. And this is a sad story because it turns out that we've lost a lot of our bumblebees in the past century. And the evidence for that is a new study that looked at the abundance of bumblebees historically and then went out and tried to find the abundance nowadays. And it turns out there's a drastic difference for many of these species.
Are these declines all around the world or in one particular place?
The researchers were focusing on the U.S., but they've also seen bumblebee declines in the U.K. They think because they destroyed a lot of the hedges between fields in order to make bigger fields, and they think that, you know, they were destroying bumblebee habitat, and that's why they have fewer there.
Is there any understanding now that this decline's been measured about what's causing the decline in the U.S., if not a habitat loss?
Well, there's a certain parasite that's plagued bumblebees in Europe. And they did find that the rate of infection was much higher in populations of dwindling species and not so bad for species that were stable. So they think that this could be part of the reason, but they say that there has to be more research into that to pin it down.
And so what's the next step?
Well, the next step is to really nail down the cause. And, you know, 3 of the 4 declining species were closely related. So it could be that they have the same genetic susceptibility to this particular parasite. So that's an argument for the parasite being the cause. The parasite might have come to the U.S. in bees from Europe that were imported to try to raise the numbers of bumblebees in the U.S., which is kind of ironic because then the solution to the declining population of bees could actually be part of the ongoing problem. So breeders who raise these bees, which are so important because of the pollinating they do and the fact that they're kind of sturdier than honeybees and can fly through rougher weather. They really need to make sure that their facilities are disease-free if we want to protect the bees from this parasite and start increasing their numbers again.
Okay, so last one. What's this last one about?
Well, this last story is about something that biomedical researchers have been looking for a long time, and that's something called a biomarker for a disease. So the idea is that no matter where the disease is in the body, it leaves traces in the blood. And it would be really great if you could just, you know, test blood to see if someone had Alzheimer's, for example.
What are these biomarkers?
Well, in this case, the researchers were looking at antibodies, which the immune system churns out when there's a bacteria or a virus present. It turns out that autoimmune and other type of diseases also generate antibodies. So those antibodies could potentially be used as a biomarker for those diseases.
So do researchers know which antibodies to look for in the blood for these various diseases like Alzheimer's, say?
They don't, and that's what makes this problem so difficult. So there's one strategy, which is figure out exactly which molecule produces the antibodies so that you know which ones to look for. But this group kind of took the strategy of throw everything at the blood and see what sticks. So they basically took, you know, 15,000 synthetic proteins that had been used in drug development and looked to see which antibodies they bound to in the blood of people with lupus or Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and things like that. And they actually had a good result for Alzheimer's disease. They found two antibodies at high levels in six people with Alzheimer's. And when they looked at the blood of people with Parkinson's or lupus, they didn't find these antibodies. And they also found it in 16 other Alzheimer's patients. So these two antibodies could be a potential biomarker.
And so these antibodies weren't found in high levels in healthy people?
Well, they had 16 healthy controls, and it also turned up in high numbers in two of them. So that could mean that these biomarkers aren't specific to Alzheimer's, but it turns out that the two people with these elevated antibody levels were older women. So it could be that they actually have early Alzheimer's, but the researchers don't really know. But there's another complication to this, because as people get older, their immune systems produce a lot more dysfunctional antibodies. So it could just be that these people are old, and that's why they have these elevated levels.
Is there a history of this type of technique working?
Actually, biomarker research has a pretty poor record. So this could be yet another kind of false trail. But the researchers have formed a company to really look into it and try to develop it. And they're really excited about it. So there's hope.
With the idea that if you can identify early stages of Alzheimer's better, you might be able to do something better to prevent it.
One would hope, but unfortunately there aren't any treatments for Alzheimer's right now. But that could change in the future. So then it would be really good to know, you know, early on whether you had Alzheimer's so that you could get treatment faster.
Okay. Well, thanks, Lauren.
Thanks, Rob.
Science's Lauren Schenkman sitting in for David Grimm with a selection of stories from our online daily news site, Science Now. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories on the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.